Tonight, we're going to move on into chapter 20 of Luke and take up the question, who should be sovereign? Sovereign means say-so. Who should have the say-so? Who should be in charge? God says, as the creator of the universe, he is sovereign. But we don't like that. And the human race and God have a difference of opinion on this issue. In Luke 20, we have a series of encounters between Christ and some of his enemies that kind of center around this whole issue of the sovereignty of God. The context for the study starts back in chapter 19, where we read that Jesus, now having entered Jerusalem during the last week of his life, people were so excited. If you were here last week, we studied the triumphal entry, and people thought, oh, finally, Jesus is going to take the throne and lead Israel to victory. And so everyone was anticipating that, large crowds gathering for his teaching. Instead of assuming the throne or something, he does this. We read that he entered the temple area and began driving out those who were selling. According to one account, he made a whip of cords and was whipping away at these people and turning over their tables, knocking the money all over the floor, shouting at them as he did. It is written, he said to them, my house will be a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of robbers. And so this is apparently the second time that he had done what was called the cleansing of the temple, throwing out the money changers and the sellers of animals. They had people selling sheep, selling goats, selling pigeons in the courts of the temple. This is actually on the Temple Mount, but not inside of the temple, but right around it on the porches that they had built there. Now, it's important for us to understand a little bit about the background. We can understand more about why he did this today based on information that has come to light through historical study. It seems that according to Josephus, you know, there is a law in the Old Testament that when you bring a sacrifice to God, it must be a spotless lamb or spotless animal. You're not supposed to wait until one of your sheep is, you know, missing two legs and on the verge of death and think, yeah, well, we might as well take that and offer it. It's supposed to take one of the good ones. So when people would come to Jerusalem for a great festival, like the one that was just a few days away at this point, the Feast of Passover, they would bring an animal with them to give an offering in the temple in Jerusalem, which was the only place that Jews could offer sacrifice. When they got there, the priests would had an inspection service where they would check out the animal they had brought. And so often it seemed that these animals turned out to be flawed in some way. Remarkably high percentage of animals being brought up there that turned out to be not qualified. So the priest would be like, I'm sorry, this is flawed right here, and this really won't qualify for the sacrifice. Well, Jews had often traveled to Jerusalem from all over the country and even from overseas, where they would come from Alexandria, from Rome, and then there was a wide dispersion of Jews, huge numbers that would come. People who would save their whole lives for this pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And so when you're there and now your goat or whatever has been declared flawed and disqualified for sacrifice, you're like, well, I came all the way from Alexandria with this sheep. What am I supposed to do now? And they'd say, well, out in the court we have a service we offer people, and if you take it out there, they'll buy your flawed sheep. And they have some that we've already pre-inspected that are definitely flawless, and those will qualify. So you go out, and of course, the flawed sheep, well, that's not worth that much compared to the one that is unflawed, unspotless. So they'll give you a little bit of money for yours. Of course, the spotless one, very expensive. According to Josephus, 4 to 5 times the market value of a sheep or a goat. Also, what was going on then, they were making a very handsome profit on these animals. And of course, for the privilege of having a stall to sell spotless sheep and the service of getting their sheep pre-inspected and all of that, there was a lucrative kickback to the priests. So in other words, the priests had set up a rule and interpreted it in such a way that they were bleeding people for large sums of money to these sellers, and then there was a kickback to themselves, and so they were profiting from their own inspections. This trade was quite lucrative. It was the same thing, by the way, with the money changers. They refer to the money changers. It seems that most of the coins, almost all of the coins in use, they didn't have paper money. It was all coinage in their currency. It would have the picture of the guy, the ruler, usually Caesar. This was in Roman times. And so most of their money had Caesar's picture on it. Well, Caesar, of course, was revered by people as a god. And he declared himself a god. And so the priest's position on this would be, this is essentially an idol, an object of worship, this piece of money. And so for us to put this in the temple treasury, that would profane the temple. And so you can't give it. And one of the things that every Jewish male was expected to do at once during his lifetime was pay a temple tax. So they, again, would have Roman money that was useless. But if you go out into the courtyards, there are guys here who have a certain Syrian shekel that has nobody's picture on it. And they'll change your fallen idol money for the Syrian shekel, and that is qualified for the temple tax. Well, of course, there was a percentage, a substantial markup on the exchange, a kickback to the priests. And so it was the same thing. The pigeons were there because poor people couldn't afford a sheep or a goat. All they could afford was a pigeon, and the same thing would happen with the pigeons. Of course, the suspicion was that when they brought your flawed sheep or whatever and sold you the good one, that maybe a day or so later, that very same flawed sheep would turn up in the flawless bin and be sold again, you know. And so there was actually a rotation. Now, I don't know that that was ever proven, but that's what Josephus suspected was happening. And you know, anybody that's going to be shifty and rapacious like this probably would go ahead and do something like that. This trade, this whole process of religious flim-flam was bleeding poor people of money that was very hard to come by in that time. And it was so lucrative. We read again in Josephus that in AD BC, when Pompey, who was the conqueror of Israel for Rome, came into to Jerusalem, he levied a tax on them to pay for his army, which they could not pay. They didn't have any money for it. And therefore, he went into the temple and took gold and silver from the temple. It says he did not want to impoverish the temple completely. So he only took a portion of the gold and silver there, 80,000 talents. A talent is 6 or 7 pounds of gold or silver. 80,000 he took, the rest he left. That's the kind of, that's, you know, it's millions. So it's hundreds of millions of dollars bled from a very poor culture. That's the kind of profiteering that was going on here. It was corrupt. It was a radical, extreme interpretation of something said in the Old Testament that was taken way beyond its intent, probably for the purpose of making money. And so nothing changed from then till now. Religious leaders bleeding people mercilessly for their money in the name of God, enriching themselves till they have fabulous wealth, and all of this as nothing more than a flim-flam, a scam, on people who in their heart, in all sincerity, thought they were coming to worship God, but were actually coming to line the pockets of a religious shyster. God's really upset about this kind of stuff. This is very upsetting to God. Now, we already read earlier that you talked about, when I get a hold of people who stumble the faith of my little ones. You know, I'm gonna treat them hard. It's gonna be rough. And this is why Jesus was so enraged about this practice that he actually dared to whip people out as he chased them out of the temple. Of course, what he did there, not good for business, not really appreciated by the leadership who were profiting from it. And so this may have been a straw that broke the camel's back. But we read that their attitude went very much worse after this. According to verse 47, every day Jesus was teaching at the temple, but the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the leaders among the people were trying to kill him. It's very important to remember this is the motivational base behind these leaders as we read about the confrontations to follow. They had basically already made up their mind, this guy must go. The problem is there were difficulties with them killing Christ. For one thing, it says they could not find any way to do it because all the people hung on his words. And it's clear that the multitudes listening to Christ in this immense temple courtyard that is the size of several football fields were, you know, thousands of people. And they loved the things that Jesus was teaching. So for them to come in with a posse and arrest him in the presence of a big crowd like that could easily, probably would have provoked an immediate riot. And the Romans were merciless in their treatment of any city or place that had a riot. So they simply, it just wasn't as easy as going in and taking him. Besides which, under Roman law, the Jewish leadership was not authorized to practice capital punishment. They could punish. They could beat people. They could imprison people. But they could not put people to death. The Romans reserved the right to do that to themselves. And so if the Jews felt someone deserved execution, they had to go convince the Romans that that was the case. And they didn't want to beat Jesus or imprison him. They wanted him dead. And so there was an effort then in the confrontations which followed to catch Christ doing something that would be incriminating enough that it could get him convicted and sentenced to death by the Roman government. And so the confrontation between Jesus and these leaders comes to a head. We read an account in 20 verse 1 to 7 that really kind of pictures, I think, the response that Jesus has toward what we could call pseudo-seeking. It says in verse 1 that one day as he was teaching the people in the temple courtyard and preaching the gospel, the chief priests and teachers of the law, together with the elders, came up to him. And here comes a delegation of top leadership of the country, the chief priests, probably the highest position in the country. They say, tell us by what authority you're doing these things and who gave you this authority. Well, you know, that could be a pretty legitimate question, really, in the right context. I think we've all probably wondered that at one time or another. Why should Jesus be authoritative? You know, why him? Why not someone else? What sets him apart? In a way, this could have been a perfectly legitimate question. Under the circumstances, he was probably trying to get him to name some authority that they could say contradicted the authority of Rome. Anyway, he replied to them, I'll ask you a question, he says. Tell me, John's baptism, this is referring to John the Baptist, he says, was it from heaven or was it from men? And when he says from heaven or from men, what he means is, was John a spokesman for God like he claimed he was, or did he make this stuff up himself, that it's purely human creation. False, in other words. And so they get together and they gather in sort of a little huddle and they start to talk about it. And they're like, well, let's see now. If we say John's baptism was from heaven, from God, then he's going to say, why didn't you believe him? Because these same leaders had opposed John before they opposed Jesus. Everyone else got baptized by John, but these guys had fought him and resisted him the whole way. So we better not say that. And then, of course, if we say, well, he was just making it up, then, you know, here's the crowd again. They don't believe that. And they're going to stone us. They'll throw stones. They'll probably kill us out here if we say something like that. So that's probably not a very good idea either. And so they come walking back, and they break the huddle and come walking back to Christ. And I'm like, we don't know where it's from. Well, that's interesting. And what's even more interesting is Jesus' reply to them. He says, well, then I won't tell you by what authority I'm doing these things. That's interesting. Very interesting, I think. You know, their reply that they gave, completely cynical. They're not back in the their huddle saying, do you think John was from God? Maybe he was for real. No, I don't think so. No, that never came up. They didn't care where his authority came from. That was never discussed there. What was their concern? If we say this, then that'll look this way. If we say that, it'll look the other way. You know, we got to think of the crowd here and so on. Their entire intent was nothing but political. They remind us of politicians, the way they're carrying on. And so what they come back with has nothing to do with a question of truth. They weren't interested in that part. Neither, of course, were they interested in where Jesus' authority really came from. This entire thing was nothing but an effort to lay a trap for him. They weren't about to change their attitude toward Christ. And Christ, by asking this question and putting him on the spot, had immediately and completely unveiled the intent of their heart. Like the top scholarship of the country, present through the same events as everyone else, comes forward, and all they can say is, we don't know. And it showed the cynicism that was underlying. And of course, then Jesus' response, his refusal then to answer their question, how odd. Hey, he had said it plenty of times before. I mean, we've read several passages already in Luke where he said what his authority base was, that I speak from my Father, my words don't come from myself. But on this occasion, sorry, no answer. That's because they weren't seeking in a true way at all. And their question was phony. And so his answer to them, silence. No answer. And in this sense, it's typical, I think, of what we can expect from God himself. Because I personally know what it's like to be in their situation, to be in the setting of the leadership here that was questioning Christ. One of the things I used to get a kick out of when I was a non-Christian was I'd get a few friends, and we'd go out and get high, and then we go to a Bible study, some evangelicals we knew, and never to learn anything about God or to possibly meet God personally. That was the furthest thing from our mind at that point. The reason we went was because it was a gas to make fun of the things that they were saying there and to point out how stupid some of them were, and also to poke holes in their arguments and raise a ruckus during a meeting, to get into debates with people. And so here, they would go through their Bible study and talking about all their things to do with God and singing their songs and everything else, and we'd be like, oh man, you know. Sometimes we got into arguments afterwards with the Christians. They would want to save us souls. So we enjoyed that. Because some of the points they would make were just so silly. And so we'd have a little sport with them. And I remember times when someone said, well, why don't you just at least ask God to show himself to you? And I'd be like, okay, God, show yourself. Look, burn this bush. Make cats fall out of the sky. Whatever. It's up to you. Go ahead right now. And, you know, I'd be like, hey, I don't know what to say. Nothing's happening. Truthfully, in my life, it was that way. You know, God basically was as silent as he could be. The TV screen was black. He had nothing to say to me. And that is exactly what we can expect anytime we come to God with a chip on our shoulder, with an arrogant attitude, not really interested in knowing him, not really interested in bringing him into our lives, only there to tweak the nose or to create an impression. God says nothing at all. Nothing. You know, in the medieval period, a lot of times king's courts had what they called the court jester. which is often a little guy, often handicapped. But they put these funny-looking clothes on him, and he would dance and flop around and carry on in the court to everyone's amusement. You know, he was kind of a funny guy. And they could throw things at him and give him a hard time, and he would go through various antics. That's what some of us want to see God as. You know, it's like, okay, God, if you're real, you know, such and so, do this. And God looks down, he says, you know, I'm not your court jester. You get this all wrong. I am God. I'm not going to come down and dance for you. Okay, if you want to come to me, then you come to me. And you come on your knees. You come in a posture of complete humility and obedience. Because I am a sovereign God. I'm not going to grovel in front of my creatures and plead with them to know me. And of course, God can look right past our words and right into our heart itself. He knows exactly what our attitude is. I can't personally see that. So I always treat people politely, even when I'm suspicious that they're really being quite sarcastic or cynical with me. I just think it's the safer course. But God doesn't have that problem. He knows exactly what our attitude is. And the fact of the matter is that often, even if God showed us whatever it is we call for, we would have no intention of following him even then. I know I never did. Silence greets the cynical questioner. And so we go past to yet another encounter. The story of the evil vintners. A vintner is somebody that works with grapevines and makes wine in the winemaking business. This one starts in verse 9. He went on to tell a parable. He says, a man planted a vineyard and rented it to some farmers and went away for a long time. Now, according to the longer, there's a longer version of this parable in Mark 12 that you can read for comparison. It's the same parable, but Mark just included more of the material than Luke did. It also comments in that passage that he built a large wall around the vineyard for security, that he planted it with good grapevines, and that was quite a process to get the slips and the right cuttings to grow. And then in the middle of the vineyard, he built a wine press. So this would be one of the better vineyards because, you know, you didn't have to take your grapes by cart down to the village wine press, but you had your own press in the middle of your own vineyard. So it was a nice vineyard. He rents it to some farmers, to some vintners, so they can make their living there. He didn't give it to them. He rented it to them, right? It's still his. He goes away on a journey for a long time. At harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants so they would give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. That's how they paid their rent, payment in kind, where the landlord gets, you know, a certain percentage of the harvest. That's your rent. But the tenants didn't pay the rent. They beat the servant up and sent him away empty-handed. They're like, rent? Yeah, we got some rent for you. Boom! Right? Keep the change. Now get out of here. He sent another servant. Well, they beat that one too and treated him shamefully and sent him away empty-handed. He sent still a third, and they wounded him and threw him out. Mark says, and so with many others, beating some and killing others. Wow. That would never happen, would it? I mean, I'm sure some of you are landlords, probably have an investment property somewhere. Would you put up with this from your tenants? The beat the people you send down there for the rent? Kill some of them? You can't do that. And many, he says. He said, and so every time this happens, you just keep sending another one. Finally, the owner of the vineyard said, now what am I going to do? Beaten everyone I sent to kill some of them. I think I'll send my son, whom I love. Maybe they'll respect him. Wow. Bad idea, man. It's really a bad idea. Well, when the tenants saw him, they talked the matter over. Hey, this is the heir. They said, let's kill him, and then the inheritance will be ours. Yeah. And so they threw him out of the vineyard, and they killed him. Well, this this story, this is really pretty a pretty bizarre story, right? Quite extreme. Can you imagine this? Hard to imagine. What is wrong with this landlord anyway? I mean, I guess we can see there's a problem with the tenants. You know, they got a real bad attitude, and they're intent on apparently not paying any rent, and yet their actions, you know, kind of fit with their motives. I mean, you can understand what they're doing, but the landlord, what a confusing figure he is. Why does he just keep sending more servants? And then his own son. Of course, at the end of the story, what then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. Just when it seems like, well, this guy must be the biggest sissy that ever lived. Hey, apparently all he's able to do is send servants and get them beaten up. It turns out in the end, no, actually, he's powerful. And so to interpret this parable, let's think about what are we reading here and what's being said. The parable's told from the viewpoint of the owner. And the owner is God. And Jesus is telling us a story. This is how it looks to God, his dealings with you all. In the story, the owner is amazingly soft and tolerant. Incredibly. I mean, it's just almost ridiculous that any owner would be as accepting and as gracious to just keep sending many servants and have them beaten and killed like this. In fact, he's so gracious and he's so tolerant that it really appears that he seems weak. It must be that that's the best he can do. You know, he's just simply unable to enforce his will. You can imagine the last guy comes dragging himself over the thing, bleeding, bruised. And he's like, oh, yeah, wow, they beat you. I guess I better send another servant, right? Number 69, you're up. How would you like to be, servant number 28 going down to the evil vintner's place? That'd be a drag. Well, there is something to think about there, though. If you did go down there and you got beaten up, one thing you'd have to realize as one of the servant's messengers, these people don't hate me personally, right? It's not personal. Their problem is with the owner. And that's why they got hostile toward me. And that is a little footnote here for those, any of here who may be Christians who are actively witnessing. Sometimes I know I've experienced this thing where I've barely opened my mouth to share what I'm into with somebody, and I have gotten this ferocious, angry reaction from friends who normally don't care what you say or talk about or what opinion you express. But all of a sudden, I bring up something about Jesus Christ, and you know, I get this attack and come walking out of there, and I'm like, wow, man. And we have to remember, it's not personal. Okay, that's not you that they have the problem with. Anyway, something to think about there. Well, in the end, it turns out that the owner's not weak at all. He's got plenty of strength to enforce his will and indeed to destroy these people. At any time, he could have done that. Probably came in with a posse of his personal army. And that's the way they would do it. He'd bring 20 armed men in there, round them up, take care of it. And that could have happened at any time, but it didn't, it didn't, it didn't happen, it didn't happen. And finally, it happened. And so, although he seemed so tolerant that that he was a weakling, it was really just a matter, apparently, of him being very merciful and trying to give them as many chances as he could, but there was a limit. Finally, they reached a limit. And there were no more chances after that. And so this is really supposed to be a picture of God, Creator God. And in the first place, this is directed against the leadership of Israel at that time. And their vineyard, I guess, would be the nation that they were leading. I don't know. Anyway, they're gone now anyway. So I think, though, that the principle applies in a broader way to all of us, which is that God has placed us in a really nice vineyard. the world. He's given us, he's set us up, basically, with a way of life. And as we covered when we studied the talents, though, we're accountable to him still. He hasn't just given all of this to us and walked away, as the deist would claim. But in fact, that we're still accountable to God for that stewardship. And that we owe God something because he set us up and created us and set us up here. We owe him something for that. We're renters. But we don't want to pay. We basically refuse to acknowledge our landlord, just like they did. And sometimes with violence and fury. Yes, that part fits too in many cases. Not all, maybe. And yet, certainly God could look at all the string of the prophets that he had sent in the Old Testament time. Most of them were beaten, imprisoned, and many were killed. Yes, that was very common. Hardly any of them were accepted and treated with any kind of respect or honor. And so this is really a picture of the conflict between God and the human race. The human race determined to rule God out, determined we don't need him, and I don't need anybody telling me what to do in my life, because I'm going to do what I want to do. And thus we have a history of the human race, sad indeed. According to the Bible, this is really at the root of the problems of the human race, is their wholesale turning away from following God. And although we may even say, I believe in God, and may have some arm's length ritualistic relation to God, the fact of the matter is we don't want him messing in our daily lives. We don't want the personal relationship. We don't want to have to depend on him. We want to remain sovereign. We want to remain as we're in control, not to come under the authority and the leadership of someone else. It's the last thing we need in our lives. And thus we end up in a conflict with God, a battle. The amazing thing is God lets us go. You know, he doesn't turn to us and say, oh yeah, you're not going to listen to me. I'll destroy you right now. I'll strike you with lightning. He could do that. But what does he do? Nothing. Nothing, 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 nothing. So on it goes. And, you know, people start to wonder, well, if there's a God, where is he? How come he never does anything? Why hasn't he come and, you know, where is all this power he's supposed to have? And it's easy to get the wrong impression. That's it. The mercy of God, in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10, Peter says, God's not slow concerning his promise. He's going to come back. But he says, he is a loving, and he wants as many people as possible. He doesn't want to see anyone perish. He wants to see everyone come to a knowledge of the truth. That's why he holds back. His motivation is a motivation of love, of mercy, of grace. That's why he just tolerantly continues to allow the revolution to go on. But there is a limit. The day will come when the tolerance is at an end. Let's think about it from their perspective. What would these people say, these evil vintners? Well, they would probably say, okay, so we beat some of these people up. The thing is, you know, he wants us to pay him rent, pay him part of our harvest for this so-called vineyard that we live in. He says he built a wall around it. Oh, yeah. Did he mention the wall isn't tall enough? Any determined thief could get over a wall. Look at the design. This wall is a joke. This wall is pitiful. He says he planted it with grapevines. He didn't mention these vines are low yield. These vines are pitiful. You know, we got to be out here scratching in the dirt. They've got to be weeded constantly, fertilized. Even then, we get a meager, yes, there's a harvest, but I mean, my God, these are terrible grapes. So he built a wine press in the middle of the vineyard. The problem is, it's a bad design. It doesn't work that well. We certainly don't like it. We think it's a ridiculous design. So here we are down here in the hot sun, scratching around in the dirt, watering, trying to coax a meager harvest out of these low-yield things. And Then he goes away on his journeys, and then he wants to come down and send down here and get some of our miserable, low-yield harvest that we've brought. He has the nerve to make us have to give up this little bit that we have left. Hell yes, we beat his guy up. And if he sends someone else down, we're going to beat him up too. Yeah, we wasted a few of them. What about it? I'm kind of imagining this part. Okay. It must be something like that. I'm sure they had their line of argument. I mean, what they were doing probably made sense in their minds. And I've heard this logic myself, and I've even shared it, spoken this logic. You know, whoa, look at the world we live in. You know, if God's so great, and the logic is, God expects me to respect and follow him when he's plopped me into the middle of a world like this? Where is the evidence of his goodness? We could still interrogate their position, couldn't we? What about the question of ownership? Are they, in fact, the owners of the vineyard, or are they only renters? They're renters. They owe rent. And they're acting like they're the owners. They're completely ignoring an obligation that is there. Of course, there is a harvest every year. They may say it's low yield, and yet, you know, they're making their living off of it, right? We don't see any eagerness on their part to get away from the vineyard. In fact, we find them scheming that if we kill the son, then we can own it. It seems like they don't hate it that much, right? In fact, a lot of times the complaints and the negativity about the vineyard or the thing that we've been created into is nothing but an excuse. Yes, there are problems. That may be true. And yet we're sitting here living in a life full of benefit, a life full of blessing from God. And we're choosing to completely ignore all the good that God has built into this spectacular world in which we live. That we don't want to look at. We don't want to acknowledge the creator of it. This is what God is saying about the human race. Let's go to the real question. What is it that we fear about acknowledging God's sovereignty? We tell ourselves that I really loathe the idea of coming under an external authority like God and his word. I don't want him, you know, if I become a follower of God, just think of all the things I'll have to give up. Just think of all of the restriction. That's going to be miserable. I can just see myself eating spinach every day. I can see myself living like a monk. The self-denial is going to be such a heavy burden. I don't know if I can stand that. I have to get out and live on my own. I have to do what I want to do. Then I'll have my freedom. If I can just stay away from the sovereignty of God and not come under, you know, maybe when I'm old, when I'm 60 and I don't care anymore. Maybe then. But I want the experience. I want the joy. I want a verve in life. And yet, what's the truth of the situation? All of our scheming for autonomy, all of our thought that this is what I need is to do my thing, none of it works. We find ourselves instead not entering into some glorious freedom and a life of happiness and pleasure. Objectively, if we stop and look at our lives living apart from God, we realize very often we can look and say, actually, my life's quite empty. Truthfully, I'm so disappointed with my life. So much of what I thought it would be has never happened. It's never materialized. Instead, I find myself addicted to this, enslaved to that habit, unable to change here, unable to succeed in relationships there, relatively lonely, wandering about through life without any clear sense of purpose or direction, not really sure why I'm even here or what matters. All that we thought we would gain by avoiding the authority of God, none of it comes to pass. Jesus says in Matthew 11:29-30, take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm gentle and humble in heart, and you'll find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. You know, a yoke. That's like, I'm sure you've probably seen a horse and carriage before, and they put a yoke, or oxen, you know, with a cart, you put the yoke is what you hook them into. So it's a constraint. Yes, there's a constraint there. God says, you know, you come under my leadership. Yes, I am going to direct you then. The thing is, you need a leader. You need guidance and direction in your life. And he says, it's remarkably light. You'll find it won't bother you at all. Why? Because for one thing, I am gentle and humble in heart. I love you. The only reason why I want to guide you at all is because I care about you enough to keep you from destroying your lives. I'm basically just telling you to do this, which is what's good for you. That's the reason. He says, you can have your autonomous freedom and ignore me and try to seek a pleasure and a fulfillment that way. Or you can come to me and take my yoke upon you, and he says, you'll find rest for your souls. And all of this is literally true. This is what I believe. Well, it was certainly this way in my life. After years of living, hating the idea of following God, I had to admit my life was as empty, as trashed, as purposeless as ever. I could honestly stand and look up and think, I'm more miserable today than at any time in my life. The trend was straight downward. And today, after turning to God and welcoming this yoke, if you want to call it that, acknowledging his sovereignty, I can sit here many years later and say, today, I do have purpose of my life. Christ has shown me how to succeed in relationships. God has filled my life with spiritual blessing and purpose. I understand what it's all about now. And truthfully, I'm more fulfilled today than at any time in my life. This is the way we were made to live. In this contention, this struggle between ourselves and God, we need to run up the white flag and acknowledge God as our leader and our authority. That's the only way to find rest for our souls. Let's read on. He says in verse 19, the teachers of the law and the chief priests looked for a way to arrest him immediately because they knew he had spoken this parable against them, but they were afraid of the people. So, keeping a close watch on him, they sent spies who pretended to be honest, and they hoped to catch Jesus in something he said so they might hand him over to the power and authority of the governor so he could be executed. So the spies question him. Here come the plants, the undercover workers, up to Christ. Teacher, we know you speak and teach what is right, and that you don't show partiality, but you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. So, you know, we're really wading in it now. It's like, what a lead in. They say, we just have one question for you. Is it right for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Oh, you know, this is really pretty good. This is a good one here. If you really think about it, remember that they were conquered people under the rule of Rome. They hated the Romans, hated them. And particularly the fact that the Romans were bleeding them for heavy taxes. So many of them argued, in fact, that we take money that God gave to us and we hand it over to this heathen militant power so they can take it back and build new armies to come and oppress us even more. Worshippers of idols, really in a sense, it's like giving your money to the devil. An argument that had a certain plausibility to it. So, you know, if Jesus stood up there in this situation and said, well, yeah, I think we should pay our taxes, this would infuriate the crowd, totally turn them off. People would be like, well, forget him. The crowd dissipates, then they don't have that problem anymore, and they've got him. On the other hand, if he says, now, you know, the Romans really don't have any right to that money, and they shouldn't even be in this country. That alone was a capital crime. Without any question, they'd have no trouble getting a conviction. If Jesus called into question, or anyone called into question, the Romans' right to, to levy taxes. So it looks like no matter what he answers on this, he's history. It's a good trap. Well done. Especially introduced with a nice liberal dose of BS at the beginning here. Jesus, it says, saw through their duplicity. And he said to them, show me a denarius. Whose portrait and inscription are on it? Denarius, probably the main coin in use, Roman money. They find one, they hold it up. Caesar's picture. Whose inscription's on it? Caesar's inscription. They replied. And he said to them, then give unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and give unto God what is God's. Well done. I like it. I don't know if I would have done that well here. And really, you know, it's pretty profound when you think about it. The denarius had Caesar's picture on it, showing that he was the one that had minted that coin, as this was Roman government money. Of course, in our case, whose image is on us? According to the Bible, humans are created in the image of God. That in fact, every one of us inherently knows in our heart, when we look into ourselves, I am a creature that is exalted well above what I see in the animal world, that there is something about me that tells me I am a personal being, a thinking, responsible, moral agent. The very fact that we all argue that there's such a thing as moral right and wrong shows that we all know this about ourselves. Because if we were in a purely material world, if we were just material beings like animals, it wouldn't matter what, you know, there would be no such thing as moral right and wrong. What is right. But we all know better than that, every one of us. We all know that there is the image of God on us, that there is a personhood within me similar to God's own personhood. And if we're supposed to give unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, well, that which he has made, then the logic is clear. Give unto God what he has made, yourself. And so, again, he's basically saying you need to submit to the sovereignty of God as your creator. They decided, and there was a little bit more, we're going to have to draw it to a close. They decided they were unable to trap him in what he had said there in public, and they were astonished by his answer. They became silent. And so they withdrew until a more opportune occasion. So in conclusion, what are we reading then in this sword play, this dialogue between Christ and his enemies? The central question, who should be sovereign? Us or God? Is there a legitimacy to God's right to be our leader? Are we in fact uprooted and living a wild and miserable life because of the fact that we're refusing to come under God's leadership? What happens when we deny God's sovereignty? We choke off the opportunity to be under God's protection. That in fact we realize I need direction in my life. I have no direction in my life. To guide my life simply by the principle of me is inadequate. We weren't made to live that way. We need a leader. A leader who loves us, a leader who knows better than I do myself, a leader whose ideas about how to live my life are better than anything I can come up with. And we need to subscribe ourselves in an unqualified way, in a trusting way, a trusting that he's good, and subscribe ourselves to his leadership and sovereignty. When we do offer ourselves to the leadership of God, over a relatively short period of time, our life begins to come into focus. We begin to understand why things are the way they are, what my role in it is, why I've been placed here, and how my life can matter and be significant for all time. We begin to understand why it is that I fail at relationships and the steps I can take with the power of God's help to repair relationships and to have real love in my life, to heal the lonely feeling that's there. And, you know, that ain't bad. That yoke is pretty light. Finding rest for your soul. That's what God offers us. Okay, we'll draw the line there for tonight. Right, do we have any comments or questions then? There's someone right up in front here.
Dennis, I know that having God's sovereignty in your life, I've found it to be a process, and you kind of go deeper and deeper. It's like peeling layers off of an onion. Can you give some ideas of things that have worked good for you to try and accelerate the process?
Well, yes, there would be a number of things. When we say that we're under the sovereignty or the leadership of God, that may be a dead letter. Maybe that's the intent of our hearts, and yet it's almost meaningless because we don't know what God wants us to do. So I think one of the most important things here is to get deeply and immediately involved in a study of the Scriptures. In the Scriptures, we find out what, when we say following God, follow Him where? He explains that in the Bible. And it's not something that is extremely easy to get. It takes a certain amount of study. We have to apply ourselves to learning the Word in order to understand what God's asking of us. I think it's also helpful to get involved with a smaller group of fellow Christians who are traveling the same path, who can support me in it, who are often have gained wisdom in different areas so that they can offer guidance and suggestions. And there are struggles that we face and trying to follow God, and there are difficulties along the way. So I think we need the help of good friends who understand what it is we're trying to do, so it becomes kind of a joint project that we're following God together. I think if we get deeply into learning the Scriptures, if we get deeply into involvement in a home group, let's say, with some fellow Christians who are intent on this as well, or maybe a men's group or a women's group. There are lots of different options here. I think we're well on our way. At this point, it becomes I think the most common area of trouble that we run into is that we form the intent to follow God, and then we kind of go back on our own intent, and the struggle is really with myself, that I'm ambivalent, and sometimes I want to follow God, and sometimes I want to resist Him. So this struggle with self, this struggle with the flesh, the lower nature, is something that God helps us out with, and He will get alongside of us and help us gradually overcome the tendencies of what the Bible calls the lower nature, this fallen aspect of ourselves. And some of that, it will include a certain amount of trials and suffering in our lives as well. So I think He basically places us in situations where our old techniques and methods of coping won't work anymore. And this throws us back into a need to trust God in a deeper way, in a new way. And that's sort of an ongoing process then of learning as we walk, you know, learning what it really means to follow God. So those are three concrete areas I think we can look at. Let's try one more over here.
Yeah, Dennis, maybe to go along with what you were just saying, I know when I first became a Christian, I believed in Christ. At that moment, I acknowledged His sovereignty because I wanted salvation. I didn't want to go to hell. I wanted to live eternally. But I knew He wanted me to live a different way, and I didn't want to have anything to do with that. I especially didn't want to be associated with Christians.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just thought they had their acts together or something. They go to church every week, and I didn't want that lifestyle. So for 6 months, I did it my own way, and it didn't exactly work the way I wanted it to. So I came to fellowship. I finally moved to Columbus and came to fellowship, and it was completely God just like blew away my expectations of what it meant to be a Bible-believing Christian. And I think it's easy to think that it means you just go to church once a week and dress differently or something, you don't cuss anymore or something. And so when you talked about reading the Bible and being involved in relationships, I'd maybe add to that, learning how to love others deeply changes your life. It challenges your selfishness, but there's just something about being committed to other people, and you can only do that in a smaller context of people. You can't come to a meeting like this just once a week and expect to grow very deeply in your relationship with God.
Yeah. It's something we have to do in community. It's something we do together. And you know, when you come to God and say, I'm willing to follow you, what do you want? You know, the first thing he basically tells us is, go over with these people here, and they'll help you from there. So I think that the relational aspect of Christianity is so immense that we are doomed to complete superficiality unless we're willing to get in there with fellow Christians and learn it that way. Let's turn to God. Lord, you are God. You are the Creator. We know this in our hearts. You're there. We didn't just happen here by accident. No way. And Lord, we owe you our allegiance. We owe you the willingness to acknowledge, just to acknowledge the truth. You put us here. You are our Creator. You know more about all of this stuff than we ever will. And so we realize we should be willing to follow you. The more we think about it and what you went through, Lord, by sending Christ here, by taking upon him our sin, taking away the need for us to stand judgment, and we can now have eternal life as a free gift, we realize that your goodness must be very profound indeed. You must be a very good and loving God. You're the kind of person we can trust. And that's what we want to do tonight, Lord, is place ourselves actively in your hands to offer ourselves as your followers. Not to say we're good people, not to say that we have earned your favor at all, Lord, but just that we're willing now to accept your love and to follow you. We say that in Christ's name. Amen.